From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You're getting these stories about heartbreak and love and children they wish they had and they didn't have and rings they shouldn't have bought. It was a very wild experience as editors to experience the six-word memoir onslaught.
Could six-word memoirs be the big new literary trend? Well, perhaps. We'll look at lives boiled down to six words today as we look at language. Also, comedian actor Rick Moranis tries on a new hat, a cowboy hat, with an album of country music.
I might have been watching MSNBC and seen the NTSB investigate some FAA thing with TWA. I mean, we're just surrounded by acronyms.
That's also just ahead on TT Book. I mean, To the Best of Our Knowledge. And we'll meet a trailblazing linguist who studied the world's lowliest languages.
If we didn't have this power to create language, we would be a very different species and probably still running around on the savannas.
Ow.
But first, Elizabeth Little, a writer and editor living in New York City. Little is the author of a book called Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. In the summer of 2000, she found herself in China.
I had been traveling sort of all day, and Chinese buses are not known for their smooth ride and comfortable accoutrement. So I arrived in this town called Nanchang, which is not very well known, and for a good reason. It's not the most exciting city. But once I'd gotten there, I was ravenous, and so the first thing I did was find a restaurant. And I was so exhausted, I knew that I just wouldn't be able to deal with a full-on Chinese menu, because Chinese menus in China are just as they are in the U.S., which is to say, you know, 18 pages of all of these different possible dishes, and I was terrible with food vocabulary. So I very politely sort of went up to the hostess and asked her in Chinese, I was like, would you happen to have an English menu? And she just looked at me as if I were speaking Vulcan. She had absolutely no idea what I was trying to say, and it was so humiliating because, you know, I'd been there for about 2 months at that point, and I was like, at the very least, I should be able to ask for an English menu. The problem was, in Mandarin, you have to speak each syllable with a certain tone, either a sort of hold steady tone or a rising tone, because if you get the wrong tone with the syllable, then you actually change the meaning of the word itself. So when you're starting a Chinese language class, the first thing you do is learn these four tones. And you can always tell if somebody's in a beginning class because they just walk around muttering to themselves over and over, ma, 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 ma. It's all they do. I took it my freshman year of college. Yeah. And you just would walk down the halls and hear it echoing. And so the first tone, which is the ma, was actually really, really hard for me at first because it was so much higher than I expected. And I'm just terrible at all sorts of singing. So every time I had to say the word for menu, which is zai dan, I would say something completely different. And to this day, I don't know what they were hearing, but it certainly wasn't menu. So after about, I don't know, 5 or 6 minutes of me getting progressively more frantic and trying to say zai dan over and over with, you know, ever progressively higher, I'd be like, zai dan, zai dan. And no one understanding me. Finally, from the back of the restaurant, I hear this waitress yell out, 这个很大的外国人要一个菜单, which means the huge foreigner wants a menu. And that was sort of both the highlight and the low light of my time in China.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's a challenging language, to be sure. And I wasn't helped by the fact that I am, both here and in China, a giant. I'm about 6'1". So everywhere I went in China, that was the first real phrase that I knew in China, which was 那么大, which is just like, how huge.
But you stuck with it. In fact, languages seem to have become the great compulsion of your life.
They are. And, you know, it's despite the fact that I'm certainly not one of those linguistic geniuses. You know, everybody knows somebody who can just be dropped off sort of in the middle of nowhere, not knowing a word of the language, and sort of by the end of the day, they've ended up in the local bar and, you know, they're playing drinking games and talking as if they've grown up with the language. I'm certainly not one of those people. I really do struggle with language, but I love the challenge and I love the game of it, the puzzle, the trying to figure out, you know, which words go where and how the different patterns of language work. So for me, it's really the great joy of my life.
Is that what it is that attracts you so much, the puzzle?
It is in large part. I love the way I study languages. I tend to look for the sort of underlying patterns. It doesn't always show up in textbooks. You know, I look at noun declensions and verb conjugations and try to find out sort of the cleverest way to trick my brain into remembering it. But I also just love travel more than anything else. I love interacting with other cultures. I love meeting other people. And so language study, even when I'm not actually abroad, even when I'm sitting in my rather tiny apartment in Queens, it still gives me the feeling of learning something new about the world. And that's really where most of the impetus derives from.
So what was your first language? English, but then what was the first one you learned in addition?
The first one I learned was French, and that's because my father is from Canada. And, you know, even though I was growing up in St. Louis and couldn't ski and certainly was never going to play ice hockey, he was going to have me learn at least a little bit of French as soon as he could to sort of feel like I was doing my half-Canadian duty. So he started teaching me French words when I was fairly little. Most of them revolved around the Montreal Canadiens, I have to admit. And the first sort of language performance I ever did was in kindergarten, God help me. We had a talent show, and so all the other kids were doing things like dancing and singing, and I got up there, and my talent was counting to 50 in French.
Wow.
And, right, so from a very early age, I had absolutely no self-awareness about how annoying I was about my language fixation. So French, yeah, French was my first language, and from there, it just, as soon as I got my hands on enough allowance money to go buy books at bookstores, it was all over for me.
Yeah. You even studied Latin in what was it? You said fourth grade?
Oh, yeah, it was. I went to a very sort of alternative hippie school where we studied, you know, meditation, and we were all certified earth keepers. And strangely, part of that curriculum involved all of us learning Latin. I'm not exactly sure how that sort of plays into, you know, the environmental lobby, but apparently there's some sort of connection because they began to teach us Latin verb conjugations when I was 10 or so. And the way they taught it to us was by having us sing verbs to the Mexican hat dance. So this was the first time I really started to be excited about
Can you still do that?
Patterns. Yes, I can. It's amo, amas, amat, amamis, amantis, amant. So, yeah, and it actually works brilliantly for Spanish, too, as I've discovered.
Well, and when my wife was taking Italian, it works well for that, too.
Right.
It's terrific.
It's actually very useful. Put verb conjugations to the most annoying tune you can find, and I bet you find that language learning becomes a lot easier.
You're not allowed to forget them, even though sometimes you wish you could.
I know.
One of the things that I have found fascinating, I don't speak very many languages, but I've been in places where those languages are spoken, and I always find my brain trying to turn them into English.
Mm-hmm.
You hear a phrase, I'm riding a bus in Tokyo, and I began to know, now I've forgotten what it is, of course, but I began to identify the place where I knew I had to get off.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it into an English phrase that came out of those. I'm sure it made no sense whatsoever. but I was reminded of it when I looked at the title of your book, Biting the Wax Tadpole. That, I mean, it's sort of that thing, isn't it? They take a phrase, an English phrase, and turn it into Chinese.
Exactly. So it sounds close enough to sort of make you turn your head, but it's not quite the same, and it can be very disorienting. Particularly with Asian languages, Japanese, in fact, loves appropriating English words, but they become a little different because the sounds of Japanese, although actually are surprisingly close to English, but it's definitely a foreign language. And Biting the Wax Tadpole is my favorite language story of all time, which is why I chose it as the title of the book, because not only does it get at something really fun about translation, about the ways that languages interact, but it also shows you that sometimes the best stories and the best experiences in language don't revolve around getting something entirely correct, but rather kind of about flubbing it. And I think that's a great life lesson as well.
Well, you should tell us the story behind that phrase.
Well, it comes from when Coca-Cola introduced its product to China in the 1920s. One of the big challenges that they had was translating the name into Chinese characters. And Chinese characters, of course, it's not like a Western alphabet. Each character has a sound, you know, like ma, and it also has a meaning to it. So even if you just want a phonetic transliteration, you're going to end up with a phrase that means something. So eventually Coca-Cola settled on a great sort of series of characters, which is Coca-Cola, which means sort of deliciousness in the mouth or delicious happiness. But before they were able to get their official version out there, it was still on sale, and so Chinese shopkeepers came up with their own name, which was very similar. It was Coca-Cola, but when translated literally, it meant bite the wax tadpole. And I just love the idea of people going around China and ordering up a bottle of bite the wax tadpole.
They have to know, of course,
Absolutely.
Where it came from. But you can see them smiling about it. You have similar things with American presidents' names, for instance.
Right. Yeah, it's really interesting because all of the Western names have to be transliterated like this. And for native Chinese speakers, there's sort of a set of characters that's kind of accepted as this is probably a phonetic transliteration. But if you're not a native speaker, whenever you come across this in speech or even more so in writing, you sort of have to pause and you think, you know, what exactly is going on here? And in my Chinese curriculum, it was sort of heavily focused on politics. Actually, it was incredibly impractical, I have to say. But I would always be reading these sort of policy briefs and I'd get to things. And this was, you know, back where they would have lots of sort of briefs about what's happening in the late 90s. And I'd always come across these three characters. And I would translate, I'd open up my dictionary and translate them. I would see repress, forest, pause. And I'd be thinking, what exactly does that have to do with the World Trade Organization? Repress, forest, pause? Is this some sort of Chinese political philosophy I don't know about? And then my Chinese professor would invariably read it out loud to me, and he'd sort of scold me, Lili Sha, it's Ke Lin Dun, which, of course, is Bill Clinton. And so it was actually really difficult for me. And you find that all of the literal translations of sort of presidential names tend to be extremely amusing. Things like Jimmy Carter, which is Jimmy Carter, which means literally lucky rice, card bowl. And it's just really delightful to do the transliterations.
Yeah. Of all the languages you've studied, do you have a favorite?
I don't, actually. I'm a bit of a linguistic philanderer, actually. I love the one I'm with. So for the moment, I am completely enamored of Hungarian. And I think it's just an incredibly beautiful language, as terrible as I am at pronouncing it. But if I had to choose one that is sort of my overall favorite, I would have to say ancient Greek, actually, in large part because it's utterly impractical these days, and there's something that's quite charming about that. But also because ancient Greek is the reason that I actually know so much about the way that language works and the reason I understand so much about the way my own language works. Because I think, like many people of my generation, didn't get the sort of rigorous English grammar training in school. And so it was really ancient Greek and learning how that language worked that it was through that language that I started to understand my own language. And it always reminds me of this wonderful Goethe quote, which is, only by learning a foreign language can you understand your own. And I've always thought that was quite special.
Elizabeth Little is the author of Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic.
Your dance. Your dance. Your dance.
Quick. Mama,
come on, baby,
tell
me
what
the
word, a
word, up,
everybody
say,
when
you're
called,
you got
to
get it underway,
word,
up, it's a
code, word, no
matter
where,
you say it,
you
know
that
you
will
be
heard
now,
also.
You.
Ow.
Rachel Fischleiser and Larry Smith are the editors of an online storytelling community called Smith Magazine. They're also the editors of the book Not Quite What I Was Planning, Six-Word Memoirs by Writers Famous and Obscure. Fischleiser and Smith told Anne Strainchamps what inspired them to invite people to boil down their lives to six words.
There's this classic literary legend you may have heard about Ernest Hemingway. It starts, as all great literary legends do, in a bar, where he was challenged to write a story in just six words and tell the entire story. And he came up with For Sale, Baby Shoes, Never Worn. And we always kind of love that idea. But Smith Mag is a personal storytelling site. It's all about autobiography and memoir and telling what your life has been. So we opened up the challenge as a six-word memoir. It just seemed like the logical extension of that challenge in this voyeuristic age.
Larry, you were kind of stunned by the response?
I was stunned by the response, and more inspired, I think, than stunned, because we've been asking people to tell their story at Smith Magazine. We always say, everyone has a story, everyone has a story, what's your story? And we do get lots of stories in, but putting in the parameters, six words, was a really smart idea, and giving examples, both looking back to Hemingway, and then we put up some examples of some of our favorite memoirists.
So did a lot of people write in with six-word memoirs?
Thousands and thousands. I mean, really, it was like a stampede of six-word memoirs. And we would get up every morning and sort of look at, you know, behind the scenes Smith, the back end of Smith, and see them come in and pick some of our favorites. And it was a very emotional thing to wake up at 7 in the morning. The coffee hasn't even kicked in. You're getting these stories about heartbreak and love and children they wish they had and they didn't have and rings they shouldn't have bought. It was a very wild experience as editors to experience the six-word memoir onslaught.
It got to the point where I actually didn't get out of bed first. I would just pull my laptop off my desk into my bed with me and go through the back end before I brush my teeth.
So why do you think the challenge of the six-word memoir sparked this kind of avalanche of a response?
Well, I think that when you ask people to tell their stories, it's a little bit daunting. And if you ask someone, you know, what's your memoir? They're going to say, oh, I'm not a writer. Who has the time? But you give someone these parameters and you say, just do it in six words. And it's a great way to get started.
Another reason why I think the challenge worked was that part of Smith's mission is to blend the professional and the amateur, the aspirational and the already there. So one of the first things I did was send a few memoirists I know, you know, well-known memoirists, notes and say, hey, help me get this thing rolling. So I sent Elizabeth Gilbert. She wrote Eat, Pray, Love. Probably sold more books on that memoir than anyone in the last 5 years. And I sent her a note, and she replied, running to a plane in Indonesia, but here's my official six-word memoir entry to be read in a Tarzan yet girlish voice. And Elizabeth Gilbert told us, me see world, me write stories.
And then we put it up on the site, and we put up Dave Eggers on the site, and we put up Stephen Dubner, who wrote Freakonomics. And we say to everyone out there, you know, here's Dave Eggers' life story. What's yours? We want to put it right up next to it.
What did Dave Eggers write?
15 years since last professional haircut. And that's the thing on Smith Magazine, really on many places, but Smith is really important to us. The storytelling playing field is a level one. Dave Eggers' six words are great. Elizabeth Gilbert's six words are great. But your six words, not writing for The New Yorker, not best-selling memoirs, your six words are just as important and just as good.
It's really the unknown contributors who are kind of the heart and soul of this book. And over the last year, we've gotten to know about 800 of them. And it's been really the most rewarding part of the whole thing.
So what are some of your favorites, especially from unknown writers?
Every time I read Found True Love, Married Someone Else, kind of gets me in the gut. Never should have bought that ring. I mean, people were so honest. I think when we started this out, we thought they'd be funny, they'd be clever, but we weren't prepared for the depth of emotion and the amount of honesty people were willing to put out there and slap their name on it.
And you get a lot about love and babies. As Rachel was saying about Found True Love, Married Someone Else, I was just thinking about Found True Love After 9 Months, a different sort of love. And religion was a common theme. Not a good Christian, but trying. There's a lot going on in those six words.
I like the one, and this is an entire life, being a monk stunk, better gay.
And what's nice about that is there's a real action item there. Someone took his life in his own hands and changed something.
And in big and small ways, a lot were about taking the power to change your own life, even as simple as, wasn't born a redhead, fix that.
So it seems like some of them kind of go for the big overarching kind of summing up your life, and others focus on something really narrow, like Dave Eggers' haircut.
I think that's right. And then some of them, perhaps at their most genius six words, can do both. Here's a funny one that I think does both that. It talks very narrow and very wide. Hillbilly does right by his teeth.
Wow. It's sort of like the Hemingway story. There is an entire story, you know, hidden behind the words.
There's a moment when that hillbilly got his teeth fixed, but it's also saying something about who he is as a person. I've changed, perhaps, where I started in life, and I've gone somewhere else. You can make up any backstory you want, but you really do get a story, a real story in those six words.
Like, here's another one. Ran away with circus, never returned.
And that, too, you know, it can be literal, it can be figurative. It sounds pretty figurative, but actually Ilya Visker does work with a circus in New York here. You don't need to know that. It's interesting if you do. I think that's a lot of fun, too, is that we've gotten to know people and we've gotten to hear their backstories, and it's really wonderful to hear them. We've been publishing them on the site, and they can really enrich the experience. But at the same time, one of the most fun things about this is to say to your friend, hey, turn to page 22. What do you think happened there?
Some of them are really sad. Like, I'm looking at lapsed Catholic, failed poet, unpublished prayers.
Oh. Well, that person did get published now in our book, and that, you know, it's inspiring. It's inspiring to be in a book. It's inspiring even simply to be published on the website. And I think a lot of people really found meaning in seeing their six words on Smith Magazine. This one always gets me in the gut. On the Playground Alone, 1970 today.
Oh, that's awful.
It is awful.
But a lot of people really admitted their loneliness. And I think that, you know, we're so quick to look at the really tragic ones. Was father, boys died, still sad. And that's stunning, of course. But there's also these little bits of everyday sadness and also little bits of everyday joy. And those can be just as powerful to me as the ones that tell a really big story.
Hmm. Stanley Bing, who's a pretty well-known financial writer, he came up with a little bit of joy in his life, and he tells us, happiness is a warm salami sandwich.
Cheese is the essence of life, Mary Lynch, page 154.
I sell hamburgers and French fries, Richard Moorer.
Food was a big theme. Food and love seems to be what it all comes down to.
What's Mario Batali's? That's a great one.
Well, Mario Batali's is a great backstory. We sent Mario Batali a note. And, you know, most of the memoirs, 90% of what you see in the book, came in over the transom to Smith. Don't know these people. But, indeed, we did push out to some of our favorite writers, some of our favorite storytellers. Mario Batali always says he cooks as memoir. So we wanted his six-word life story. He sent back 7 six-word memoirs, of course, in the middle of the night, very Molto Mario style. And the first one of his 7 six-word memoirs is the one we have in the book, which is quite simply, brought it to a boil often.
That's great.
You can read hundreds of thousands of words about Mario, and they're great words. I've read the book, Heat, and things like that. But, you know, that's it. Mario Batali, brought it to a boil often. The essence.
Now, you said he sent you 7 six-word memoirs, which suggests that there's something kind of addictive about writing these.
Absolutely. People get started and they just can't stop. Sometimes we'd find people had submitted 10 or 20, which is a lot of fun, and we get to pick our favorites. Often their first instinct is really right. But one of my favorite things that happened, too, is that George Saunders, who's an incredible writer, we had asked him to write for the book, and he sent in a couple. But he also sent in his email to us, you know, here are my 6-word memoirs, but he had written that in 6 words. And then he said, oh, no, I'm getting addicted. And he went on and on and on. And I felt like, if a writer like that can be so captured by our concept, then we must be onto something.
In fact, didn't Lizzie Widdicombe write about your book in The New Yorker, and her entire story is made up of 6-word sentences?
And she did it so seamlessly that half the people I've spoken to didn't realize that's what she did. We were really impressed.
Have you found yourselves kind of internalizing the rhythm of 6 words and without realizing it, speaking more and more in 6-word sentences?
It's really bad. We are addicted to 6 words, and, you know, I've been caught in the ocean with my wife looking at me from across the beach yelling, quit counting, Larry, just swim.
And I used to count everything on my fingers, and I still do a little bit, but it's also gotten to the point where I can recognize 6 words when I hear it, and my friends don't even wait for me to say it. They'll just say something, and they'll see the look on my face and go, 6 words, isn't it, Rach? Yep. Yes, it is.
So do you guys have advice for those of us who want to write our own 6-word memoirs? How do you write a good one?
The most important advice we can give you is to start. Start writing your 6-word memoirs. From there, be as specific as possible. One of our, I don't want to say favorites because we love them all differently. But
like our little babies.
Our little babies, Rachel and I like to say. The first one in the book, the alternative title, is After Harvard Had Baby with Crackhead. The words are very specific, and I think that makes for quite a good story.
Right. If you say after college, that doesn't have the same power to it. If you say with this kind of messed up guy, you know. But when you go for that specificity, I think you really get your point across. I think being honest is really important. I think it's totally scary to sit down and, you know, tell the world ex-wife and contractor now have house. But when you put it out there, it's a lot more interesting than just, hey, I had a bad year.
As his girlfriend is pregnant, my husband said.
So have you, I imagine friends of yours and family members have started writing a lot of these. Has it been surprising at all or especially emotional to hear anything friends and family members have written?
Well, it's been interesting. A lot of family members started writing them for each other. I know Larry's nephew has a story.
When I came home over Thanksgiving, right after we launched it on the site in November 2006, I was telling my family about the idea. We just put it on the site. Things were starting to come in. And they started zipping them around the table. And I thought, wow, we're really on to something. And my genius 11-year-old nephew said, oh, I wrote one for Pop-Up. And he wrote, memory loss? What was I thinking?
And my father, who I've always thought of as a pretty fun-loving, happy guy, just came right at me with, New Yorker, everything pisses me off.
Wow.
Now, six works can be used as a weapon. I know that my mom was writing, mean ones for me when she was mad at me. And she was saying, oh, here's my six-word memoir. But you probably wouldn't think that. But, no, it's, here's the thing. Above all, it's a conversation piece. I say over and over, bring this book to your next party instead of a bottle of wine, because you're always running late to get that bottle of wine anyway. Bring it in. Put it down on a coffee table. Give it to your host. It starts the conversation, and that's what we're trying to do. The larger picture of Smith Magazine is start the conversation. Tell stories. What is better than telling stories?
They're surprisingly revealing. My dad heard something about your book, and so my mother called one day and said, your father heard about the six-word memoirs. He's obsessed. He spent all day writing his. And I said, really? What did he write? Then he got on the phone and he said, worked hard, but not hard enough. That's so sad.
Right, and you just learned something about your father that perhaps knowing him all your life, you didn't know.
But I think that so much of this, too, we're starting to sound like a downer. But I think that the whole sort of message of the book, not quite what I was planning being the title, is that, life isn't all good and a lot of things will happen to us, but we tell our stories and we move on and we share things with other people and it makes things better and life may not be what you're planning, but it always seems to turn out some pretty good stuff.
All right. You can write a new six-word memoir every day.
That's true.
We had one that came into the site after we started publicizing the book. Maybe it'll be in the next one. But it was wanted to write but feared failure. And she started, right? She's writing. She just changed her story.
So you guys must have written six-word memoirs of your own. What are they?
Yep, I'm on page 12, and my six-word memoir is bespectacled, besneakered, read, and ran around. I might have invented the word besneakered, but I promise it describes me perfectly.
And mine leaves a little bit to the imagination, especially on radio. Big hair, big heart, big hurry.
Good guests, good conversation, good radio. Larry Smith and Rachel Fershlizer are the editors of Smith Magazine. They're also the editors of Not Quite What I Was Planning, six-word memoirs by writers famous and obscure. They spoke with N. Strange Champs. What would your six-word memoir be? We'd love to read it. You can send it to us through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, a trailblazing linguist finds clues to our common humanity in the world's Creole languages as we continue to explore language. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Creole languages are languages so low in the pecking order that many people don't even consider them to be languages. Creoles are spoken by descendants of slaves and indentured laborers in plantation colonies all over the world. Derek Bickerton has spent more than 30 years researching Creole languages on four continents. Bickerton writes about his Creole research in a book called Bastard Tongues, A Trailblazing Linguist Finds Clues to Our Common Humanity in the World's Lowliest Languages. Derek Bickerton gives us a little taste of the Creole languages.
Well, you can get some of my favorite sentences, such as, she must see day bad, make she takey. And what it means is, she must have been hard up if she married him.
When I first heard it, I had no clue what it was that you were saying. Did you get it?
Oh, the first time you don't get these things. I mean, when I went to, it took me about a year before I could really understand everything that people were saying.
You've studied Creole languages now for what, 30 years or so?
Uh-huh.
And you've talked to thousands of people over that time. Mm-hmm. How did you decide to pursue the research?
Well, I don't know, because I never been trained as a researcher, and it just seemed to me that if you wanted to find out what people said, you had to talk to them. But again, there was the problem that if you're an educated speaker of a standard language like English, then there are all kinds of social and emotional problems tied up with this thing. The very ambivalent attitudes of Creole speakers towards standard language speakers, which is expressed, I think, best in the Haitian, where parler français, to speak French, means to lie, and parler créole means to speak the truth.
Uh-huh.
Creole is kind of down-to-earth and vivid and homely, and it's our thing, but at the same time, people who speak it know that for this they are kind of looked down on by speakers of standard English who regard them all too often wrongly as, uneducated, unintelligent, and so on. All these kind of nasty stereotypes about Creole speakers that Creole speakers, of course, are only too well aware of. So this is a pitfall. So in other words, they're kind of tend to be a bit edgy when they're talking. It takes quite a while to kind of talk away your status when you're dealing with them. But I found, of course, the best thing is to get involved in as a participant observer in things that are going on. So in actual fact, what you're hearing is people speaking to one another rather than speaking to you.
Well, it makes sense to pursue it that way. Well, where do you go to get people to talk around you rather than to you? Because when talking to you, they'll try to speak your language, right?
Of course. The best way is to go into any kind of social atmosphere. I kind of like atmosphere in bars, so I did a lot of my work in bars. Chat with people, and before long they would get to chatting with other of their friends who happened to be there, and I would just hang out on the periphery and throw in a word here and there or just listen.
So one end of it would be the conversation that we're having, standard English.
Pretty much.
What would be at the other end?
Well, at the other end, again, would be something that would be, again, almost incomprehensible. Like if you say, oh, I'm talking to this old woman who'd never even been to school. She was a woman about 70 or 80 in the rice-growing village in Guyana. And she said to me, "Na punish di gomma, na punish abi?" And "na punish di government, a punish abi." And what that means is, isn't the government making us suffer?
So over the years of study, you've come up with several different theories of where this came from, and you've had to change your mind as mm-hmm. you've gone along. You've developed a theory which has encountered some controversy, I gather. The language bioprogram theory.
Yep, that's correct.
Will you tell us about that?
Basically, the intuition I had about that arose when I was looking at the verbal system in Guyana and comparing it with that in Hawaii, the way they use tense and aspect and things like that. This is remarkably similar, not just in those two Creoles, but in a majority of Creoles. In some cases, it's totally identical. In others, you get slight minor variations, but still the same basic system. And at first, I thought this obviously doesn't come from English. Where could it come from? The obvious source is, well, it must be one of what they call the substratum languages, which are the languages that were spoken by the parents of the original speakers, the slaves who eventually produced these languages. So I went looking for what I thought would be the source, and then something suddenly occurred to me. Supposing I found a language that had exactly the same system, how could that language, because it wasn't a common system outside of Creoles, how could that language possibly have fertilized all these other different Creoles in different parts of the world? And it seemed to me this was an impossibility.
So you stopped looking for a root language and started looking for a way in which the Creole language formed in each new location?
Yeah, and formed in the same way. And the only way I could think of was from what Chomsky's called universal grammar, that the human species has some kind, we don't understand yet how, some kind of inbuilt mechanism for producing language. And that it was this mechanism which, when it didn't get sufficient input, or when the input was kind of confused, as it was in the case of a pigeon, children would simply go ahead and spoke whatever came naturally, and that would be, of course, the same, not entirely, of course, but more or less the same in every situation.
So let me just make sure that I understand. Hmm. You have English on one hand being spoken by the masters in these situations. You have people speaking a variety of language who are in the community that will develop the Creole language.
Absolutely.
In order to communicate between the two, they have to come up with the pigeon.
Uh-huh.
The children...
Well, it's more to talk to each other. The pigeon is, of course, an emergency language. This is all the masters can use in giving their orders and so forth. But the main raison d'etre for a pigeon is for people of different languages to talk to one another, the slaves or indentured laborers or whatever, to be able to communicate with each other, because it's other slaves or indentured laborers are the ones that they're going to be in contact with most. Their contacts with the masters are going to be quite limited.
Did you come up with this theory on your own?
Yeah. Nobody had ever suggested it, and when I first put it out, nobody liked it either. It was kind of very unexpected. People hadn't ever thought about that before, and naturally, whenever you produce anything that's too new or too different, you tend to get negative reactions.
Is there still any controversy about it, or is it pretty widely accepted now?
It's very interesting. It's very widely accepted outside of Creole scholars, but there's still a lot of Creole scholars who are still skeptical, and I find that kind of bizarre, because to my mind, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming.
How do you respond to your critics? Do you just say, well, just because it doesn't fit with what you thought before? I suppose that doesn't go over very well, does it?
No, I don't say that. I just bring practical examples of critical cases where it's impossible to give any explanation other than mine.
Well, assuming that your theory is correct, and certainly it is widespread, what do you think that it tells us about the way we learn languages in general?
Yeah, that's maybe the most fascinating part, because I've always been suspicious of this kind of little linguist model in which a child is supposed to, listen to the language and induce grammatical rules and all that kind of thing. I think simply what happens is this, in normal acquisition, the children learn words. And that's all they actually learn. They don't actually learn constructions at all, because once they have words, they can start putting them together with this mechanism. Again, this is something that we still don't understand. We're nowhere near understanding it. We're a little nearer than we were when I got into this, but there's a long way to go.
So listening to Creole, you're hearing some of the same construction, the same process that you hear in general language learning.
Yeah, very often.
Which means that your title's all wrong. These are not bastard tongues, are they?
Not at all. The reason I chose that, well, first of all, it's a great title, I think. Memorable, anyway. And the other thing was that this is how they've been regarded. I say at some point, I think early on in the book, I say that, they were despised by everybody and nobody knew who their real parents were. So what else could you call them? This is the classic definition of a bastard. But no, of course they're not. On the contrary, they represent our common source, what makes us human. Because if we didn't have this power to create language, we would be a very different species and probably still running around on the savannas.
Derek Bickerton is the author of Bastard Tongues. A trailblazing linguist finds clues to our common humanity in the world's lowliest languages. You can find a link to his website on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, actor and comedian Rick Moranis, alias the agoraphobic cowboy, as we conclude our Hour on Language. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Rick Moranis has enjoyed a very successful career as an actor, comedian and writer. He's appeared in such films as Ghostbusters, Little Shop of Horrors, and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. He was also a cast member of the critically acclaimed sketch comedy television series SCTV during the late 1970s and early 80s. But over the past few years, Moranis has been trying his hand at something a little bit different, writing and performing country music songs. These songs demonstrate his witty way with words and have been featured on an album called The Agoraphobic Cowboy. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon prepared this feature on his fellow Canadian, Rick Moranis.
I work all day to pay the rent. Before the money's earned, well, it's all been allocated. I got nothing on my plate, but I wish that I were fat. 9 more gallons and I'll have me a hat. Working nights, I'm always tired. I hope my boss doesn't get me laid off. It's hard to pull an empty load, even if you're stuck. 17 more wheels and I'll have me a truck. 2 more times a lady, 3 more 100 blows, 4 more easy pieces, 5 more days on the road. 7 more days a week now, 8 more lives a cat. 9 more gallons and I'll have me a hat.
I've always loved the narrative in country music, and I've always loved the humor in country music. Growing up in Canada, and Gordon Lightfoot being the premier recording artist and songwriter of the country, they never told us that that was country music, and yet every Gordon Lightfoot song could be called that. So the definitions are very vague. Even the word country itself these days encompasses such a broad description of the kinds of music that fall under it, from bluegrass to rockabilly to honky-tonk and on and on and on and on and on. But going way back, I love the early humorous crossover songs that made it into the pop charts in the 60s, the Roger Millers and the Statler Brothers, and loved Ray Stevens stuff. I just thought there are a few places where you can do humor in music successfully, one being Broadway and off-Broadway kinds of show tunes. There's some hilarious, wonderful music there, obviously. There's some great, great, hilarious jazz songs that make their way around, though it's very hard to hear them because there are so few places that play jazz. And then there's country, and country seems to be a place where there is a lot of wonderful, humorous storytelling. And when I started writing these, it wasn't in order to write country. It just kind of came out that way because of the music that was playing in the house and where my head was at that point. Yeah.
I never go nowhere, man. I never go nowhere. Traffic's bad out there, man. I'm saving wear and tear. I like conditioned air, man. I never go nowhere. I go upstairs, downstairs, backyard, lawn chairs, living room, bathroom, bedroom, furnace room, hot tub, cedar deck, villa, fire, washer, dryer, pantry, patio, bar, aroma, video, cold cellar, rec room, ping pong, mahjong, beer, count where, then speed dial, order in.
This song's called I Ain't Going Nowhere. It's Moranis' response to the classic country song, I've Been Everywhere. Moranis says the inspiration for this song came during a conversation with his friend Paul Perlow.
I think one day we were just talking about something and the idea for riffing off of that came out. And what felt right was it was sort of a post 9/11 kind of sentiment of where many New Yorkers and many people, and me especially, had gotten to about kind of staying home a little bit more and being less willing to venture out. Of course, that's changed for most people. I don't know. I love being at home and love being around my kids. And it just started with that and grew into something much bigger than that.
NSA, CBS,
This is a song called SOS. Its lyrics are nothing but acronyms. Moranis talks about the genesis of the song and how producer Tony Scher helped shape it.
It was just one of those things that popped into my head, and I don't know if it was anything specific. I might have been watching MSNBC and seen the NTSB investigate some FAA thing with TWA. I mean, we're just surrounded by acronyms. Or I might have been reading the paper and seen an article that had one too many acronym mentions of different short forms for companies in the body of its story. And I just thought, I'm going to try and try and build a song like this. And I tried to make little stories in the verses. I played it for Tony, and he just thought, okay, you know, all right, college cut. In the meantime, you know, people are really responding to it, so I must have touched some sort of nerve with that.
And the EQ on your voice also kind of adds to the haunting quality.
We tried a vocal with a regular mic, and then he pulled out this old little microphone that he had, and he said, try it on this. And it actually wasn't EQ'd. It was just the fact that it was, I don't know the name of the microphone or the model number, but it's this little kind of old radio mic or something that he had locked away in a cabinet. And it just gave us a different sound, so we decided to keep it.
And it's got a really neat banjo sound on it, too.
Yeah, that's all his doing. I had actually heard it a little higher tempo and a little more hard driving, and he came up with that tempo and that sort of really haunting kind of counterpoint rhythm. I thought he did a beautiful job on that.
This is hard for me to do, but I can't seem to stop myself. I know you said that we were through, and here I am, I'm calling you. Please try to understand, I see myself as your loving man. Whatever you think it is I lack, let's talk about it, call me back. Press 1 if you want me, press 2 if you don't, press 3 if you'll forgive me, press 4 if you won't, press 5 if you doubt me, press 6 if you trust, press pound if you love me, or hang up if you must.
I was curious about why so many of Moranis' lyrics focus on technology.
Or as Ali G calls it, techmology. You know, I just think it's the currency of how we live. The day starts with technology and ends with technology. We're just surrounded by it, at least urbanites are. Hard to get away from cell phones and computers and televisions and all of that on the most obvious level. I'm just constantly aware of what kind of effect that might be having, how profound an effect it might be having. I remember years ago, a lawyer that I became really friendly with in Los Angeles, he was telling me that when he first started out working out there, it would take 3 days between when he would have a phone call with a business affairs person at a studio, and they would say, well, okay, I'll get the documents over to you, and then we can talk about them. And the idea was, once all the technology changed, that there were faxes and FedExes and then ultimately the internet, that you may remember this, they talked about how much more leisure time we would all have in the face of technology. And he commented that the opposite happened. Instead of there being more leisure time, there's more work. Now, how can that possibly be? Everything is moving much, much faster, and yet the work has multiplied. And it's really simple. Just turn on the TV. There aren't 3 networks. There's 500 channels. And this is true with everything. I didn't wear the shirts and the hat and the boots and all that stuff for any sort of cover photo because I really didn't want to make some sort of comment like that. I did think, however, of putting on a holster and having a beeper and a cell phone and all of those things in it, because that's how we all walk around. I mean, my kids have cell phones and iPods and all this kind of stuff. Everyone's plugged in and wired. You can't escape it.
Does Rick Moranis have a favorite song on the agoraphobic cowboy?
Well, they're all my children. It's so hard to choose. I guess I do. You know, I wanted to see if I could write a song called Bonus Track, just because I just had this kind of little weird sick idea that it would be fun to put the words bonus track as the last cut, but not have it be a bonus track, actually be a song called Bonus Track, just to see what would happen. I had had a melody kicking around in my head, sort of a ballad melody. I mentioned Gordon Lightfoot. It actually sounded in my head a lot like something that I would have used if I were doing an impression of Lightfoot. And I had a lyric, but it wasn't really working. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll use that ballad for Bonus Track. And I wound up writing, I had a couple of ideas for what to write to attempt to write a song called Bonus Track, but I wound up writing sort of an homage to train songs and speeded up the tempo and changed a couple of things. And I played it for Tony, and he wanted to do it. So we did it. And it's a pretty straight-ahead song. It's not a comical song. I mean, the idea behind it, I guess, has a little kind of a hook to it, just trying to write a song called Bonus Track. But the song's a pretty straight-ahead song. And it's a favorite just because I think it's one of the better pieces of music on the album.
Well, I'm moving along, singing my song about coal, smoke, and valve oil and steam. Daybreak Express and the Rock Island Line, Tennessee Central, the old number 9. Full throttle boxcar, a steel driving man. Midnight and I'm doing what I can. But these trains always take me away from you, and right away I wanna get back. So I'm leaving here tonight, I'm the next one that comes. I'm riding on the bonus track.
That's actor, comedian, writer, and country music singer Rick Moranis with a song called Bonus Track from his album The Agoraphobic Cowboy. Moranis spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 316A, Language, the Dress of Thought. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, and Strain Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.